and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people who are known today as the Stockbridge Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley's conversation with Howie Hawkins, Green Party nominee for governor, about the ways the Democratic Party in New York suppresses third parties. Then roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talks with the current and former presidents of the Albany County Labor Federation, Ibrahim Pedrinan and Bill Ritchie, about the votes to unionize at the Latham and Stuyvesant Plaza Starbucks. Later on, Jody Cowan talks with Lily Mercogliano Easton, director of Wawa Segoia, a sleepaway camp in the Berkshires, about their open house on Saturday and what campers can expect from this summer's program. After that, Andrea Cunliffe walks with curator Judith Braun through a juried exhibit of art by mothers called Painted at Night at Collar Works. And finally, for our weekly check-in with a community group, Troy Labor Council President Adam Peltier drops in with the latest. But first, here are the headlines.
Troy Councilwoman Kimberly Ash McPherson resigned from the City Council on Thursday morning, a day after she pleaded guilty to a federal criminal charge related to ballot fraud in last year's elections.
A judge has denied a motion to dismiss two felony charges against Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin for campaign finance fraud. The charges originate from November 2017, when McLaughlin was still a state assemblyman.
After 68 years, the Scotia-based Orlando School of Dance will close this weekend following Saturday's recital at Proctor's Theater in Schenectady.
And the House of Representatives passed a wide-ranging gun control bill Wednesday in response to recent mass shootings that would raise the age limit for purchasing a semi-automatic rifle and prohibit the sale of ammunition magazines with a capacity of more than 15 rounds. But the bill has almost no chance of becoming law as the Senate pursues negotiations focused on improving mental health programs, bolstering school security, and enhancing background checks. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. If you like what you hear, you can find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
And to learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
New York State Democrats changed the laws to make it largely impossible for independent third parties to get on the ballot for statewide office. Mark Dunley talks with Green Party gubernatorial nominee Howie Hawkins about the Democrats' ongoing efforts to suppress electoral challenges in New York.
We're talking with Howie Hawkins, Green Party nominee for governor in New York State in 2002. He's run for governor three times previously and gotten the party official ballot status. But we're talking to Howie because, you know, the state changed the law to make it much more difficult for third parties, especially independent third parties, to qualify for the ballot. Needed this time around to get 45,000 signatures, three times as much as it was previously. And it appears that the head of the Democratic Party, Jay Jacobs, Nassau County Dems and State Dems, has challenged not only Howie's petitions, but all the third party petitions. So Howie, what's going on with these challenges here?
Well, it's clear the Democrats don't want competition, particularly from their left. I mean, Jay Jacobs, the chair of the Democratic State Committee, he pushed to increase the ballot access requirements as part of a public financing commission that was set up to implement public campaign finance. Changing access to the ballot was not their charge. And they did, you know, the legislature basically gave them the right to write a law, but in court, the court said, a commission can't do that. The legislature's got to do that. So that was the end of 2019 and early 2020. So in April 2020, when the legislature is only meeting virtually during the COVID lockdown, former Governor Cuomo, with Jay Jacobs cheerleading, attached a ballot access bill, you know, we call it the ballot access exclusion bill, to the state budget package. So it had to pass, and it, you know, it passed without scrutiny. It was just sort of announced a few days before it happened. And so now New York has the hardest ballot access petition for, you know, governor that we can find, not just in the United States, but around the world. I mean, the nearest hardest petition I've been able to find is in Putin's Russia. And if you want to run for the highest office from an oblast, which is like their states, it's the representative to the state Duma, which is like their Congress. And that's 15,000 signatures in 45 days. We now have to get 45,000 in 42 days. The old New York standard was 15,000 in 42 days, a little bit harder than the Putin standard. But we've, you know, drafted a bill for the state legislature to bring us back to the pre-2020 standard, which was difficult, but not crazy like what we have now. And I'd tell these legislators, we just want to get back to the Putin standard. And they'd chuckle and they'd say, you're right. But, you know, the Democrats we talked to didn't want to stick their neck out before the election and get the governor on their back. So we don't have a bill introduced yet. So that's, you know, one of our goals right now is to get back to a more reasonable ballot access standard.
Now, the Green Party, Libertarians, I believe the Working Families Party, you know, had all filed various lawsuits, you know, challenging the ballot access changes. They particularly went into the federal court, but it does not seem, at least at the federal judge here in these cases, have been particularly sympathetic that this is an unconstitutional restriction on, you know, First Amendment right to association and free speech.
Yeah, that's been the case so far. We have a case jointly with the Libertarians that at the district level, the judge ruled against us in a pretty infuriating decision because the opinion had its facts wrong. And we pointed out, but apparently the judge didn't read it or comprehend it. So we're on appeal. The hearing may be in the fall, but I'm not counting on the courts to do justice here. I think we really got to get legislation. I think that's our safest bet.
Now, I think at the high point, you had about 5% of the vote. And I should mention, I've been active in supporting your campaigns in the past. But, you know, why should the average voter or even the average, you know, activist, you know, be concerned about the fact that the Democrats are, you know, basically making sure that no one other than the Republicans get the right to run against them in elections?
Well, the average voter, according to the polls, over 60%, want more options on the ballot. They want a viable third party. And, you know, the Democrats are making it so you just have two choices. Now, the fusion appendages of the major parties, like the Working Families Party and the Democrats and the conservatives and the Republicans, means you have four ballot lines, but only two candidates. And that's really not much of a choice. We should have a multi-party democracy. So the average voter already wants that. And then activists, particularly progressive activists, I mean, how are they going to vote for the New York Health Act, for a state-level Medicare for All plan? It's very popular. The Democrats said if they got control of the Senate, they would pass it. They did that in 2018. And since then, it hasn't even got out of committee. Or for public renewables, having the New York Power Authority have the authority to build renewable energy generation so we can accelerate our move toward clean energy and address the climate crisis. I mean, these are progressive alternatives that you can't vote for if the Green Party's not on the ballot. So progressive activists should certainly be concerned about this, because otherwise they're going to have a choice between a corporate centrist at best, Kathy Hochul, the Democrat, and a Trump-loving extremist, Lee Zeldin, for the Republicans. You know, where progressives, they don't have an option on the ballot. So they should be concerned about this.
Now, where does your candidacy, you know, go from here? Particularly the Democrats, you know, the reality is, with requiring 45,000 signatures in 42 days, it's pretty impossible for anybody to actually get that, especially with all the restrictions and technicalities that one has to meet. So, you know, what does the Green Party, what does Howie Hawkins do at this point?
Well, I think we push this bill. You know, the 42-day deadline or period in which you can petition is pretty unique. I mean, most states, if they do have a limit on when you can start, it's many months or even years before the petition is due. Most states have no limits. So they have a petition signature requirement, but you basically, you know, have a lot of time to get it. Here, we got a frantic 42-day chase, which is a real problem. Where we go from here is we keep pushing that ballot. And, you know, if we are successfully knocked off the ballot, we're talking about running a write-in campaign that will feature these democracy issues, not just ballot access, but the other things that will create a multi-party democracy: ranked choice voting for the statewide offices and proportional ranked choice voting, so we get proportional representation in the state legislature. So that's ranked choice voting in multi-member districts. We have a democracy crisis. We know the Republicans are attacking voting rights, and they're setting it up so they can steal elections by getting control of election administration in about 20 of the states. But in states like New York, as well as Nevada, Arkansas, some other states, the Democrats are suppressing the vote by suppressing the Green Party. And we know that most Green Party voters wouldn't vote if we're not on the ballot. We know from the 2015 presidential election exit poll that 61% of Jill Stein's voters would have stayed home if she wasn't on the ballot. So, you know, Democrats get all self-righteous about what the Republicans are doing, but they're doing it themselves in a different way.
Now, we have about 90 seconds left. You mentioned, you know, the Democrats didn't deal with New York Health, didn't deal with public power, but, you know, how would you rate the recently concluded, you know, legislative sessions on issues that you and the Green Party are raising in 1 minute?
Pretty low. I mean, there was a dozen climate bills, a couple of them the least consequential passed, New York Health Act, you know, healthcare, housing issues. There was a good cause eviction legislation that didn't pass. Not even on the radar is something we want, is an expansion of public housing and have a state authority, because the federal government limits the amount of public housing so that everybody has an affordable housing option. Criminal justice reform, reform for immigrants. There was a whole slew of progressive legislation, and the Democrats have a supermajority in both chambers of the legislature, but they didn't get it done. And, you know, I said they couldn't get it done. The fact is they chose not to get it done, and that's a problem.
So Howie Hawkins, Green Party nominee for governor, you got a website?
Yeah, our campaign website is www.hawkinsmatera, one word, .org. And Matera is spelled M-A-T-T-E-R-A.
Thank you very much, Howie Hawkins. And this has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
So you were listening to Howie Hawkins, the Green Party's nominee for governor, talking about the ways the Democratic Party in New York suppresses electoral challenges by third parties and is behaving in anti-democratic ways.
Next, we have our weekly labor bucket, and roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talks with the current and past presidents of the Albany County Labor Council about workers' recent votes to unionize at the Latham and Stuyvesant Plaza Starbucks.
Willie Terry, a roaming labor correspondent for the Hustle Mohawk Network, and I'm here today at the Starbucks on Troy Schenectady Road with a couple of union leaders.
Ibrahim.
Bill Ritchie. And we're here today because this Starbucks was one of the Starbucks in the Capital Region that voted to form a union. And last night, we got the news that there was another Starbucks in the Stuyvesant Plaza that voted to form a union.
Yep.
And so we're gonna kind of talk about that a little bit.
Great.
And see how that came about. So how y'all doing?
Pretty good. Great. I'm honored to be here with my predecessor in the Labor Council, Bill Ritchie, and the roving labor correspondent who always keeps me on my toes, Willie Terry.
Thank you. All right. So, look at while we get started, by Abraham, why don't you just tell us a little bit about the struggle that went on here at the Stuyvesant Plan?
Well, so we've got three Starbucks in the Capital Region that have announced their organizing campaign. We've got the Latham Plaza, which is where we're at now, Stuyvesant Plaza, and then Malta. And two of those have officially had their votes. So this Latham Plaza location was the first to announce, and therefore also the first to vote. They voted May 17th. Their vote was a lot closer than they thought. There was a lot of union busting going on. There's been a lot of union busting going on at every location. But this location did have a successful victory of 8-6 on May 17th. So we welcomed them to the union family here in Albany. And then we knew that June 7th was going to be the vote for Stuyvesant Plaza. Stuyvesant Plaza then, after the first victorious vote, there was a lot more attention to try to drive the numbers down. The problem is that backfired pretty substantially. They had a unanimous clean sweep, 15-0, knocked it out of the park, kick butt, took names, victory last night, and so we're super proud of them. And now, unfortunately, that means that Malta, who's been getting a lot of union busting, like kind of double-decker union busting, is now going to be kind of a really big battleground. There's going to be, you know, district-level... they've got two stores. There's a store that is going through a renovation, so their team and their manager has gone down to Malta. And that just creates, you know, kind of double the pressure. And now that the second store is done, that only leaves one store in the hopper, and that means that district management can also focus their attention there. So I think we're going to see a big struggle ahead. We've already seen lots and lots and lots of unfair labor practices around the country, but we've seen a lot of unfair labor practices in the Starbucks in the Capital Region, and it just points out the need to do a lot of substantial labor law reform, to pass the PRO Act, to build back better with our unions, and to make sure that we're really passing legislation that centers workers, which is the majority. I mean, that's what democracy is focusing on the majority, and that's what focusing on workers does. You usually have one boss and 20 workers, or, you know, two bosses and 100 workers, or whatever the metrics are. And so, you know, taking care of the workers, not the bosses, is the way to go.
And I want to let our audience know that we are sitting outside the Starbucks restaurant, and we have ordered some beverages. And Abraham, you had mentioned your beverage. What was that?
Oh, so I got a nitro cold brew with the sweet cream, and it is oh so smooth and oh so delicious. And my little label says Union Yes Ibrahim. So if you're using a Starbucks app for either rewards or for payment, you can go in and change your name to Union Yes, you know, with your name, or, you know, Union Bill, or Union Yes Willie, or Unions Rock Ibrahim, or whatever. You can do that to make sure that the workers know that you support what they're up to. You know, Starbucks has kind of gotten wise to the fact that people are doing this, and they've kind of... We haven't seen the directive exactly, but the idea is that they're stopping the workers from calling out Union Bill or Union Willie. So, you know, again, just another way to target workers, to, you know, union bust. And really, I mean, one of the things that we've seen, and I think this is the frustrating thing, is we've seen that, like, management is willing to harm customers in order to maintain their control and power, which is really wild. Senator Michelle Hinchey and Senator Rachel May were both at the Stuyvesant Plaza location last week, and management came up and we were taking just regular old selfies together, and management came up, the district manager came up and said, you can't take pictures, that we've got to protect the people in the background of the picture. There were no people in the background of the pictures, but because they specifically knew that we were union people, that we were union proud, union strong. You know, they were willing to come to us and tell us to stop doing something that anybody else, you know, teenage girls, you know, working class men, like whoever, they didn't care that it was two senators and labor leaders. They cared that these were people who supported their unionizing effort, and they were going to do anything that they could to bust that up.
Well, let me bring Bill Ritchie into this conversation.
Please.
Come on up, Bill.
Come on up, Bill.
Bill, I mean, it's about 9 o'clock this morning. It's
right.
A nice morning, though.
But beautiful morning,
but
right?
You have to wake up and get here.
I did it.
Right? So, Bill, give me your thoughts on this struggle around the Starbucks.
Well, I think that the struggle, as far as it's gone, has really managed to pull back the veil in terms of the rampant anti-union sentiment which exists among the management. They are absolutely crazed about keeping control, absolute control of their stores, absolute control of their workers, and they're perfectly willing to do this at the expense of anybody in that universe, you know, including customers, right? As Ibrahim just pointed out, you know, and I think that I was really thrilled when I got the news last night that the vote was 15-0. That is a very, very significant union vote, right? No question about that. And we're looking forward to what's going to be happening in Malta. And as Ibrahim points out, what's happening in Malta is outrageous in terms of the way that the workers are being treated. And we need to be very cognizant of that. The other thing that I would like to say is that we have now to start looking face forward and to really start thinking about how what level of support and how much support we can give to the workers who have voted to unionize, right? Because as everybody knows, the first struggle is to get yourself recognized, and the second and protracted struggle is to get your first contract, right? And we know that in some cases that has taken a year, it has taken 2 years, it's taken 3 years. I think that the community, broadly speaking, is probably a lot more simpatico in terms of the union organizing efforts which are going on here. I think that the whole culture, as defined not by the people using or the people working in the store, the union culture, the anti-union culture, has been really exposed. And I think it's really important for us, all of us, union, non-union, whoever you are, to stand behind the people who are organizing, because everybody is going to be benefiting from what's actually happening at this store, at Stuyvesant, and hopefully at Malta.
And Bill, I see you got the New York State United Teachers jacket on,
right,
along with the Starbucks sticker. Tell me a little bit about, I'm going to ask Abraham the same question, but tell me a little bit about your labors.
About, sorry?
Your history and involvement in labor.
Oh, my history.
Yeah.
Oh, I was the president of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor for, I can't remember, 10 years, I think it was. Still standing, as I keep saying. but anyway, long before that, I was involved with teachers' unions, you know. And I was very lucky to be able to work with Tony McCann from Shenandoah. And he and I sort of were able to alter to some degree the policies of NYSET through the annual convention and the submission of resolutions, you know. We had good victories way back in the late 80s, early 90s in terms of the fight against apartheid, for example, right? And I was really pleased to see that NYSET more recently has been encouraging the organizing which has been taking place here and at other Starbucks. They've come out and they've been putting stuff out to their members, and they're encouraging them to support the organizing campaigns, which I think is it's really important to have that type of broad-based, statewide, if necessary, nationwide support when you're involved with the sort of people that the folks in this store and the folks in other stores are going to have to deal with. We're dealing with a group of people who are, they're relentless in terms of their absolutely madly self-centered desire to control things, you know what I'm saying? And of course, to control profits.
That was roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry with his weekly labor report, which comes every Thursday evening and Friday morning.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Muncie community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
And now, if you're looking to send your kids to camp this summer, Wawa Sigawea is holding an open house Saturday, June 11th at 2 p.m. on its grounds in the Berkshire Mountains. Producer Jody Cowan brings us the news.
All right, take a brochure, and if you want to come to camp this summer, I am the person to talk to. And then if you want to make an apple, calm down. My name is Lily Mercoliano Easton, and I'm the camp director at Camp Wawa Sigawea. And we're out here at the South End Night Market because we're getting ready for summer. Super excited. We have our first session starting on June 26th. It is not too late to come out to camp for a week. That first session is a week long. We have a great group coming, brand new campers, kids who have been there for a couple of years. Just so looking forward to spending our time outside, swimming, boating, playing pretty much all the time. And we have an open house coming up on Saturday, June 11th. That's at 2 p.m. We're out in the beautiful Berkshires. It's about an hour and 15 minutes from Albany, a little bit longer from like Dutchess County in the Poughkeepsie area. And we just can't wait to get out.
Thank you for joining Hudson Mohawk Magazine. You and I are both alumni of this camp. What is it that excites you specifically each year that's just like, this is it, we're getting back into camp mode?
Well, I really love being there watching kids fall in love with camp. It's amazing. When I came back, it had been like 20 years or something since I had been like in college working at camp. And I didn't know if kids would still be like into sleepaway summer camp. I didn't know if they would like to play games where you build things out of cardboard. And I didn't know how they would feel about big dances at the end and a candlelight ceremony and kind of all those things that we love to do. And they love it so much. And that's really incredible. Last summer was just really amazing to have all that joy and get back out at camp. And we just love to see it grow. Most recently, the Capital District YMCA ran camp for maybe 3 years. And that was about 10 years ago. So there is a more recent like direct connection. We're an independent camp now. We're run by a volunteer board of directors, which is really led by camp alumni. But we did have that connection here for a while. I think it was just word of mouth in the Capital District because the Poughkeepsie YMCA ran it, and I guess it just spread.
Can you touch on a little bit about the escape of summer camp?
It's amazing. I was there yesterday and the smell is like the sweetest thing, which I always forget about it. And yesterday I stepped out of the car and I was like, oh, right, this is just so wonderful. So we have 450 acres and we're in a secluded part of the Berkshires. So it's kind of amazing to go someplace that's secluded in the middle of a place that's secluded, you know, but you're just, usually most kids are about an hour and a half from home. Some come up from New York City, so it's more like 2.5 hours, or some come from Boston, which is 3, you know, but it's not a forever distance from home. But when you're there, you know, we really have our little ecosystem. We're right on a beautiful spring-fed pond. We have just really fun facilities. Everybody lives on one little row of cabins, and we get to just really be present together. There's no Wi-Fi, it's totally unplugged. There's no cell service, so kids leave their phones at home, and us adults get to too. And so we get to really be in that day-to-day.
As somebody that, you know, has been involved with this from year to year, what is new this year?
So something that I'm so excited about is we put in a new fishing dock. And we're excited about that because we love to use our lake. We love to use the water. Fishing has been really popular the last couple of years, and we've kind of crammed it in where we try to fish when we're not swimming and all that. So now we have a beautiful fishing dock, and it's great. It fit right where all these trees have come down. It's like where everyone likes to go fish anyways, but now you don't have to fish just from a boat. So we have that happening. We've added 2 weeks of camp. So now we're up to 6 weeks of camp. We have these 1 week sessions. We have international staff coming back to camp this summer, which is really exciting. We couldn't do that last year. And so now we have folks coming from Brazil, the Dominican Republic, and Colombia, in addition to our staff that's from all over the Northeast and the South. So lots of things.
Can you touch on the difference between, for at least the beginning of camp, those first couple of sessions that are more kind of children-oriented versus the family camp stuff that happens at the end of the summer?
Yeah, so we wrap up our summer in August, August 8th through 14th. We have 2 sessions of family camp. And family camp is awesome because it's all ages. A lot of times we have toddlers and babies. We have grandparents. We have family friends. We have, like, just everything mixed in. And when we're out there for family camp, we have a great yoga teacher that comes out, Nikki. And Nikki Rogers, who's based out of the Capital District, and we do crafts and we eat our meals together. And it's kind of like camp, but you get to choose everything you do all day, and families really make it like whatever way they want it to go.
I know you're still looking for volunteers at this point before the first session kicks off. What is it that you have to do, and what is it you're looking for people to get into this year?
Yeah, I hope people will come out. We have the next 2 Saturdays we're at camp. We're also offering, if folks want to stay over, we just roll it right into Sunday. And our volunteer work weekends are just such a nice way to unplug. Really, it's mutually very beneficial. When you come out, there's a huge variety of things to do, from like raking leaves, fixing things, depending on people's skills. We have some great volunteers who are also happy to teach. Right now we're building some new dining hall tables. We're rehabbing some of our historic oak tables, and people are plugging in, learning how to do that. We're always painting and cleaning. We're always doing something on the water. So lots of different things, and it's any skill level. Families are welcome to come out.
And this is different than the open house. What can people expect to see at the open house event?
Yeah, so the open house will have tours, we'll have cabins set up, so you can really get a feel for what it's like in those kind of family style units. And we'll also open up our waterfront, and if the weather is good. And if the weather isn't good, you get to experience camp in the rain, which is its own special treat, and we're well equipped for it.
There's been so many different types of and levels of anxiety over the last couple of years, especially in the last couple of weeks. Why is summer camp, and especially Segoia, the perfect remedy for some of these anxieties?
I think what gets so special about camp is that opportunity to really focus on the relationships in front of you. And also that opportunity for young people to be supported, to really, you know, focus on joy, focus on personal challenges, focus on learning something new, and get to really concentrate on that. You know, camp it's not all year, and that's not even really the purpose of it. So when we're there, we really get to dive deep into those experiences that can be transformative, and then we get to go and take what matters most to us home, share that with other people. We have a saying just around sort of spreading the light of camp. So I think that kind of experience where you do get to step away a bit from, I mean, obviously there are anxieties at camp, but you get to step away from a lot of the bombardment of things that we have on the day-to-day, and you get to dive deep into things that you love, and meet new people and build that community. And then, you know, you get to go back out. But taking that break, I think, is great for all of us, and it's awesome to see how it can impact kids.
You and I both have the special privilege and joy of having children that are going to the camp that we got to go to. What would your kids say about camp this summer? What would they look forward to the most?
I mean, for them, it's all about the people. Yeah. And I think that's probably true for a lot of people. They just love, they have their friends. They get so excited to meet new people. We're so blessed, my family, to get to go and live there and be a part of our staff community who, you know, essentially get to then become like extended parts of our family. And I think that's what they love the best. That and like the breakfast sausage is a favorite. You know, there's all the things, the juice that we give at lunch, the punch.
Again, for those that are just looking to kind of get involved or sign up or register or just kind of get more information, where can they go?
So campwawa.org is our website. There's information there. I can also be contacted at lily@smithpark.org, and that's our parent organization, Smith Park of New York. Also just really want to encourage folks to be in touch and go ahead and register if you're interested in coming to camp. We have those 1 week sessions. It's not too late. And I want to encourage people to apply for a scholarship. We do needs-based scholarships, so we really meet families where they are. And we know that summer camp can be cost prohibitive for families, and we really want to encourage folks to consider what camp can bring to your family, whether it's for family camp or for overnight camp, and don't have cost be a hindrance.
I feel like we've all been kind of locked into our homes and our trappings and our comfortable stuff. I think it's time to find a different level of comfort in camp.
It certainly is a different level.
I know on the website there's you guys have the camp newsletter. There's the Firefly.
Yeah, we put out a quarterly newsletter. It's a lot of fun if you're new to camp or if you're alumni. We catch up with people who grew up at camp. The camp has been around for over 100 years, so there's all sorts of stories to tell, updates to provide. And this summer we'll be doing an issue that will all feature stuff from our campers, so that'll come out for the summer. And we really always have things going on, so you can find that on our website and also on social media. Some sugar sprinkled on there and some cinnamon, and you guys can make it however you want.
You've been listening to the director of the Wawa Segoia Sleep Camp Away Summer Camp, speaking with Jody Cowan. You can find that link again with the description to this story on our website, and open house is on Saturday, June 11th at 2 p.m.
So here's a question for you. How do artists who are also mothers make time for their work? Here's another one. Is there anything special about art by mothers? Painting at Night is an artist mother podcast exhibition at Collar Works in Troy, juried by Judith Braun, herself an artist, a mother, and a grandmother. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Andrea Cunliffe walks us through the gallery with Judith.
Painting at Night, artist mother podcast, and Collar Works are excited to present the third annual Painting at Night exhibition. The exhibition is juried this year by artist Judith Braun. She met me at the gallery last week, and we talked through what it was like to curate such an amazing exhibition.
I think this is like the third or fourth or several iterations of Painting at Night that have been by a group called the Artist Mother Podcast Community. It's for women who have a hard time finding time to paint, so they paint at night. You know, it's sort of like a symbol for women who have to squeeze in painting time anytime they can because they got kids and families to take care of. So the painting at night is sort of a symbolic statement.
How many artists are exhibited here? It seemed like a huge list.
Yes. Put it in context. There were 450 submissions, each one with about five images, or roughly four to six images. So it's a couple thousand images to look through. I think it was 66 artists with 77 pieces.
And are they? Where are they from?
They're from all over the country. There's one woman from Spain. For the most part, it's one piece per artist that I chose, and a few artists have two pieces in. There's a wide range of work. The invitation for the show did have an indication towards sending in work that related somewhat to your either psychological, emotional, or physical life as a mother. It doesn't have to be literal, but that's the way the invitation was for the submissions and the call for entries. And so a lot of work came in that had to do with that. It doesn't mean that those women artists are only doing that kind of work, but I did let that become prevalent, as you'll see in the show, something around that subject matter, and yet not all. As you can see, like, there's a sense of humor. These drawings are like, really, they're just so well done, so well crafted, and yet they have this humorous kind of take and this date night, and she's sweeping.
Yes.
And this wall happens to have some text. It says, "Behold the barren field in which my fucks are grown." Everything. Grieving death and loss, laid on the couch most of the day with TV on, felt guilty later.
you know, typical of what...
This wall I chose to be together. That's how the whole show is hung, in groupings that I thought hung together around something. And these are more illustrative in that way. And they're small, and they're in the monochromatic area, black and whites, handling of the drawing materials and text. So that one's a long one. We can't get into reading it.
But I'm hooked on it.
Yeah, the wandering room, and it's kind of history on that. And if you
amazing.
Every wall, you can see that they come together based on, you know, a look of the kind of pieces that are there. So, and this is a wall that I put together children's items and childlike items. So here someone did this, and I love this painting.
I do too.
A drawing, you know, it's a painting of a drawing by a child, but in the whole drawing setup. Then this artist uses quilting, and they echo each other. This person and this echo each other.
Is this a painting? Or is this a quilt? No, I don't want to touch it.
Right. It's really like collaged fabrics pieces.
Oh, wow.
And this is her also. So
these are tiles.
The same artist. So you can see how, you know, there's like a vision for the wall. I mean, in a way, when you're curating a wall, you're putting together things that look great together and have some conversation with each other. This artist, I love these two paintings of toys. And then this artist poses herself lost among the toys. And then look at the size of this beautiful drawing.
We broke me.
Very
wow, that's powerful,
words.
Isn't it?
We broke me. She's not blaming anybody. She's saying it. We did this. I broke, and it was us. The medium, the handling of that medium, to me, this is all, the green and everything is all painted, then with the letters on top of it. I mean, it's so composed and so gorgeous. And this is a beauty, too. Just so beautifully handled of a ship and... like bleeding oars, it seemed very expressive of
bleeding
oars, being at sea, you know, letting the wind is taking you, but you know, where are you going, who knows, trying to steer your ship, but you know, handled so beautifully material wise.
It's on, what is it, water? No, what is it?
Watercolor.
Yeah.
And then, so that makes our paper room, for the most part, paper. Not that nothing else is paper, but
that's your paper room.
Its own. This is fabric from a shirt pressed together like that. Sewn and pressed. I love it. To make a whole piece out of a shirt. this is, to me, another like little masterpiece. Look at her.
Is it that's a drawing?
It's a photograph.
There's something about it that
I know.
That's
it looks very
mysterious.
Like old, like it's maybe, you know, some
maybe
kind
it's
of
the way she printed
etching,
it. I don't know.
But the expression on her face and the kind of resigned but beautiful resignation, like she's a little bit at peace with her resignation. Her situation. She's accepting herself. No fussing. Her shirt just hangs. The owl appears. She's wise. I mean, she took that picture of herself and sent it to us. She knows that she caught it. You know what I mean? It's not like one of those throwaways. No, she looked at that and said, this is a piece for an art show. You know what I mean? Because look at it. It's so plain.
But it's
so
rich.
Amazing.
No,
so,
there's so much.
That's
there.
Why
it's
I
like,
love
it's
it
like
that
an
she
Italian
knew.
Classic,
yeah, yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
It's like classical.
Yeah.
She knew that she got herself.
But
there.
It's her
and
face.
And then she also takes herself looking like that. I love that. And I mean, I love so many of them. Oh, so we didn't talk about
this one. Look at this one.
And this got picked. They're using this as the card, the
ad
card. Yeah. Because it sort of absorbs a lot of the other work. It's got, it's figurative but abstract. Also, and so, and it's bold, and it does work in terms of speaking for the show. And
that's really strong.
I love it. And I like the way it's painted around the sides. You know, so it's like an object and not just a painting. And it's called Stella, so I don't know if that means Stella.
Stella! So,
and that piece got its own wall because it really didn't go with the other paintings directly. You know, it didn't fit in another group.
And what's so nice about this gallery is the pillars.
Yeah.
You know, they serve as a framing
it really
for it.
Works. I'm happy with the way the whole thing. But you know, even from a lot of work in here, and they were a little worried that I was saying, well, you know, I got a lot of, I can't get it down to 20 artists, you know, 20 pieces or something. And I said, no, you know what? If it's organized well, it'll hang, you know. It'll make sense. It won't look cluttered. I don't think it does.
But what happens is no matter where you are, it's like because I remember coming in here before and thinking, God, there's so many pillars. But you've made it work.
It works.
It works like framing around different views.
So that's the show.
What do you think? What did you learn doing this show? You learn anything?
I'll tell you one thing I learned, that when you're writing a statement about your work, you should say everything you want to say in the first sentence.
Oh, because people submit it?
Because you can't read more than you read the first two sentences. I'm not saying I didn't read them all. As I began to get into choosing work, then I would go back, and if I'm thinking between two pieces, then I would go back and reread, you know, something about their background and their intentions and stuff. But at first read, you know, if you're reading 450 of these, you're just scanning them. That means that the first sentence is important.
Where would you say the majority of the work comes from? From the Midwest, from New York, from California?
I could offhand say. There's quite a bit of local-ish, local meaning within 100 miles of Albany. But I'd say that's maybe that's half of it, and the rest of it is out, could be from anywhere. I don't remember exactly. I didn't take hardly any time to look at. I could look at the info to see where somebody's from. It's not important. It was not important.
So this call went out to...
It went out as broadly as the Artist Mother podcast goes out on Instagram.
This has been Andrea Cunla for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Thank you to Judith Braun, curator of Painting at Night, the exhibition at Collar Works Gallery in Troy, New York.
Painting at Night runs through July 31st with the artist reception at Collar's Works on June 25th from 5 to 7 p.m.
It's time once again for our weekly check-in with the community group. Today we're joined by the president of the Troy Labor Council, Adam Peltier. Adam, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for having me.
There's a whole lot going on in labor organizing today. We just heard a piece earlier in our show tonight about the victories in the Albany area Starbucks. But before we get into that, can you just back us up and tell us, what is the Troy area, the Troy Labor Council? What is it and what's the mission?
Sure. So the Troy Area Labor Council, I'll start with what we're not. We're not a labor organization that represents workers in the workplace. We are made up of delegates from different labor unions that do that. So our labor council is made up with delegates from a number of different unions around the state, and we meet once a month to figure out where there is a lot of overlapping common ground to find out what we may be able to do to help support either local organizing campaigns, local contract campaigns, or get involved in things that are just going on in the community that either has an overt connection to organized labor or maybe not, something that we just feel strongly about as our body may from time to time.
And so about how many different unions are represented by delegates?
So we have delegates from at least 10 local labor organizations. And then we have a number of delegates that come from a couple of the larger unions that represent different sections within whatever labor organization they belong to.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say we're made up of current workers, obviously, but also we have a lot of retirees who help us kind of navigate some of the problems we may find ourselves in from time to time.
Retirees can be so handy. They're not burdened down by the demands of their job, and yet they're so knowledgeable from all their years of experience. They have time on their hands and wisdom to share. And I've noticed that in coalition work that I've done with unions and councils and federations, the real strong presence of retirees. So it's not just me. There is a lot of energy around labor organizing these days, I think, both locally and nationally. Can you comment on that? Do you share that sense?
Oh, I definitely do. I've been involved in one capacity or another with the labor movement for at least the last 10 years officially. And there's not a single point in time that I can think, especially with new organizing. 2018 was also a pretty big year. That's the year that a lot of the teachers' unions were going on strike illegally in primarily Republican states. So that was exciting on that level. But I think that what's going on today is exciting on a different level, because there does seem to be an explosion of new organizing going on around the country. I was looking at some National Labor Relations Board statistics earlier, and there's already been over 1,000 organizing representation petitions filed with the National Labor Relations Board this year. And in a normal year, that number wouldn't be hit until sometime in like October, November, if at all. So yeah, there's definitely something going on.
The data bears it out. Do you think that it's related to people's experience of work during this pandemic and people realizing what's really important and how much jobs take for granted about what they can assume that they can extract from workers, and people sort of realizing, I don't think this is right for me?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. Just, there are a lot of workers over the last few years, especially with the pandemic going on, where I think that a lot of people have had their eyes opened with how disposable or replaceable they may be in the eyes of their employers. And another thing that I think is helping is it's almost a pandemic in and of itself. When people constantly hear about this group of workers here are organizing and that group of workers over there organizing, people naturally start to understand that this is something that they can and should do themselves. It's not just something that has to happen some other place. It can happen in their own workplace.
Instead of seeming very remote and improbable, it suddenly becomes quite plausible by association. So one of the things you said that you do is by coming together in sort of a coalition of unions represented by delegates, you look for synergy and overlap between the work that you're all doing to see what kind of support you can lend local campaigns in particular. What does that look like? You may mention some of the local campaigns that you're helping with, and then what does that help look like?
It can look like a lot of things. It can be a very, public thing. One of the things that we were involved with much earlier in the year was the Troy Martin Luther King Jr. event. That was very visible. It included just basically reaching out to people in all kinds of organizations, all of whom were leaders themselves, and basically getting everyone together to put together some nice programming.
You were one of the ringleaders of that operation. I'm now suddenly remembering.
I was one of I was.
Yeah, you were.
One of the people that was pretty involved.
It was a group effort, but you were pretty involved in.
Yeah, definitely. Renee Powell also. Shout out. She was one of the other primary operators. And Willie Terry, your own.
Absolutely. Our very own.
Can I just add one more?
Oh, yeah, please.
The other thing, sometimes it may just be invisible. There are sometimes things that go on where we may ask our delegates to put calls in to a certain executive director where workers are trying to organize and asking them to voluntarily recognize the union. So what we do happens in a lot of different ways, sometimes publicly, sometimes not publicly.
Behind the scenes. And then in a very case by case way, I know we've probably got about, I don't know, maybe 4 minutes left or even three. And so I'll just say right here and now, of course, we want you to come back so that we can continue this conversation that we're soon going to run out of time for. But I was particularly interested in that we've got 2 minutes left. Maybe you can tell us about the work. One of the other important things you do is endorsements in electoral campaigns. And what's your process for doing that?
So for us with the Troy Area Labor Council, it depends on the election. If it's an election where the constituency is entirely located within Troy and Rensselaer County, then we have the authority and autonomy to make our own endorsements. And what that looks like is we send out a questionnaire to the parties and they circulate them amongst their candidates. We conduct interviews, we deliberate, and then we decide to endorse or to not endorse based on the questionnaires and the interviews.
Nice.
For other elections that are statewide or across outside of the county, we have a lesser role where we recommend and have a vote on the final decision, but not the autonomy to make the decision.
That makes sense. I wonder, are there any races over which you have, you know, they're all within your jurisdiction, so to speak? Not this year, but sometimes there are. I'm just wondering if there's ever cases where you just think all the candidates are subpar and you're not going to endorse anyone.
There have been races where we've chosen not to take a position for or against anyone.
So I understand we've got our time is ticking down. We really don't have any more time left. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to having you back. Until next time.
Yeah, thank you so much. I look forward to coming back.
Thank you so much, Adam.
Bye.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Kathy Silber. Our engineer is Sina Bazila Hickey. And our content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. And we want to hear from you. We really do. How do you experience Hudson Mohawk Magazine? What resonates most with you? What could we be doing better?
And you can tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast, and you can hear those individual stories on our website, mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.